community focus.
The following WEEI public service broadcast is brought to you by the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Community Focus.
You're listening to Community Focus on WEEI with Darnell Williams from the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Good morning, everyone out there in the listening world. This is Darnell Williams, President and CEO of the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts, welcoming you once again to the Community Focus program. I'm so humbly grateful that we have David Carruthers in the studio with us this morning, and we're going to be talking about a range of items about him, about the five books that he's written, and we're going to get to know David and share David's journey with us. But before we do that, it's always what I consider a humble honor for me as the president and CEO of the Urban League to remind you that we are celebrating as we get ready to embark. In fact, this week we'll be celebrating kicking off our 100th anniversary. And for those of you who do in the listening audience who do not know that much about the Urban League, if you give me a couple of minutes, I just want to go through a few tidbits to tell you what the Urban League does and what it does not do. But on Friday, May 16th, 1919, the Boston Urban League was organized here in the city of Boston. The Urban League has a rich and a long and proud history of impact, where we have been advocates, where we really are striving to make sure that economic parity is part of the agenda. We focus in on social justice. We try to prevent domestic violence and sexual assault. And we have been the stewards in the civil rights movement throughout that 100-year history. Just a few questions I would ask you. We believe at the Urban League to be equal is an American promise. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness should belong to every American. We tried to rise to the occasion when people walked through our doors asking for help. So those that were in need came to the Urban League, and our job was to respond with our services and with our knowledge and with our experiences to put them on solid footing. We recognize over that journey in 100 years that freedom is worth marching for. In that same 100 years, we think that oftentimes our impact is not seen. However, we know it's felt. If you don't believe me, ask the people that we've helped. In that 100 years that we've been doing things, I believe that we need the Urban League more now than ever. Given the current climate that we have of racial division, when we think about the climate, talking about people who have a different sexual orientation. We talk about people who have a different faith. We have the division as part of people who came to these shores. If we don't want immigrants to come into this country, then we need to give the Statue of Liberty back to France. Because it says, bring me your huddled masses yearning to be free to these teeming shores. That means that we are open up for those folks who want to work hard, play by the rules, and come to this country and find a better way. If we're not going to do that, then give the Statue of Liberty back to France. Because that means our borders are going to be closed. We recognize with the election of President Barack Hussein Obama that there is power in the ballot. We know that in 100 years we made a difference. There was a time when people couldn't vote because they were black. Now we find black people finding reasons why they shouldn't vote. Now that's called dumb is where I came from. It says we had a phrase in the 60s that says don't buy where you can't work. Now y'all know we talked about it in a few weeks ago how we buy everything under the sun. And some of y'all ain't got no jobs, but y'all still buying stuff. But I believe that the most pressing mandate for us at the Urban League and for our listening audience, how can we break the chains and the cycle of poverty and move individuals and their families to a more prominent place of prosperity within these United States of America? I can go on. But all I want you to know is the Urban League's assignment. Our assignment that we believe is God-given is to lift people up and give them a chance to strive to have an opportunity. Because sometimes there are people who are hit harder than others. There are people who come out with these phrases that black people are like jelly beans stuck at the bottom of the bag. Or as Derek Bell said in his book, when we are at the bottom of the ladder, And whoever you are in the country, when you come to these shores, says, whatever it is that I want to be, I don't want to be down at the bottom of the ladder with them people. And that's where we've been. But we have found pride. We found dignity. We found accomplishments throughout our lives and striving to make America better because we have existed on these shores of the continent of the United States of America. So I don't know any other place. All I know is that the Urban League has been here, part of those 100 years trying to make America better, holding America accountable, making sure that why is it that people fear us because of what we represent and what we bring to the table, David. And so as we transition to our guests, that little five-minute dissertation was about the Urban League. That wasn't about me. It's about me and all of my 100 colleagues across the country in 34 states in the District of Columbia. We're headquartered in New York, and Columbus, Ohio turned 100 this year in 2018, and there are others. And while the Boston Urban League will turn 100 next year, I'm so proud to be able to share that with the listening audience so you know when people say, well, what does the Urban League do? We empower communities, and we change people's lives. That's what we do. So, David, you are in the studio. Thank you for being here, man.
Thank you for having me.
And David was supposed to be here before. I'm not going to throw him under the bus, but his GPS was off that morning. We were on the line trying to talk him here, and I'm on the right highway. And we said, well, what highway was that?
So definitely not one of my strong points.
Yeah. I know. So the GPS was not strong either.
Oh, boy.
but it turned out, we said, David, we love you. So let's do this another day, and we reschedule. But I just had to let you know we were having so much fun trying to get you here.
It was something.
It was an experience.
It definitely was.
So how's Cambridge these days?
Cambridge is fine. Oh boy,
it's close to Brighton.
It's close. It's close. Yeah, it's close. Not near though.
I know I know you're going to get me back when you get a chance.
It's all good.
Oh, boy. So why don't you tell us a little bit tell the listening audience who you are, Dave.
Okay, so born in England, came to Boston when I was 12.
Okay, stop right there.
Okay.
I want you to tell us what was that England accent. What happened to you don't have an English accent
Yeah,
now.
I don't. You know why? Because when I came here, I was in school. I came here, I think, when I was in the sixth grade.
Okay.
And I came home one day because I kept getting teased for my accent. And I came home one day, and my mother...
Your British accent?
Yes, yes. Okay. And my mother was like, what's wrong? And I said to her, Americans are mean.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, kids. I got so hammered for my accent that my mother was like, don't say bin, say trash. Don't use a knife and fork. Just use a fork. She didn't know to say, hey...
Don't use the word telly.
Yeah, right. And so she Americanized me really, really quickly.
Okay.
Then, of course, my brother comes over years later, and his accent, and all the girls are like, oh, my God, your accent's amazing. And I'm like, you're a loser, buddy.
your brother was smart.
Yeah, right. Because he was like...
He used his accent
to his advantage.
And you became indoctrinated.
Yes, exactly. I became like everybody else, and he became... the star, and he was like, American girls like me, and I was like, you're overrated, you know? But it's all good.
Civil rivalry
and jealousy. I lost something precious that I had.
You lost quite a few. When did your brother come over? If you got here when you were 12.
He came over a couple years later.
Okay.
Because we were separated, you know, and so he came over a few years later. I mean, he's still over there.
Okay.
I wasn't raised with him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he would come over every couple of years, and we would just kind of spend the summer together. They call it holiday.
Okay.
We call it vacation. Yeah, they call it holiday.
Vacation for us, holiday.
Right.
They
yeah.
do holidays in months.
Yes, they literally. Do, yes, exactly.
Like 2-3 months.
Right. Literally. Right. Yeah. Ours is like a week or two. Right. Theirs is like a month.
That's not no holiday.
Right. Yeah. It really isn't.
That's like a weekend.
Right. Right. Exactly. So you know, and then I just got Americanized, and I got But so born in England, roots are in Jamaica,
because
that's where my mother's from. That's where I don't know my father, but that's where my father's from. That's where my grandparents are from.
So wait a minute, back up. You're from London, but you're Jamaican by descent.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Okay, so now that's revealing.
Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, yeah, I guess, yeah.
But there's there are a lot of Jamaicans spent time in England.
A lot,
why,
yes.
Why is that?
I'm not sure.
You know, because know when it started or whatever?
I don't. Okay. Because there's a lot also in New York. But of course, a lot of people come over here because of the whole better life, the opportunity. I mean, that's why my mother came here. You know, because
after she left England.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about your early formative years.
I don't remember a lot of my childhood. What I do remember is that, you know, my uncles raised me to be pretty tough. I was a good fighter. So while I was getting teased in America,
honestly, you didn't use it in America.
No, I did. I didn't use it a lot. I didn't. Honestly, I didn't have to.
You didn't have to.
I didn't have to, but I used it a little bit, and I definitely wasn't afraid. One thing that was shocking though, I did come over here, was I saw about 20 guys beating up on this one guy, and I was like,
that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I was like, Americans don't fight fair. You know?
Oh, you mean there were 20 in a group?
Yeah.
Beating up one guy.
One guy.
Okay.
And I was about 12, 13 years old, so I was like, I'm not getting over in a fight over here because they don't. I came from England, and where in my day, it was one-on-one was one-on-one, and that's what you did.
Mano,
I got
mano.
Yeah, yeah. I got into a couple of fights, but not the major. Wow. You know what I mean? But I was like, these guys.
Your assignment was not to become that one.
Yes,
guy.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. My assignment. Right, right. So, I made sure I didn't do it. You know what I mean? And so it was very, very mind
altering.
Big time.
Okay.
Because I said, well, there's a whole different code of honor. I shouldn't even say of honor. There's just a whole different code over here. So you learn, and you learn quickly. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like I got robbed one time. You know what I mean? So, and in England, so here's what I do remember.
You didn't get robbed in England?
I did not get robbed in England. No, I didn't get robbed in England. But we were big on manners. We were big on. And then in England, there weren't a lot of blacks. So we were definitely the minority. And then coming over here, being teased, being called black, being called the N. I got called the N-word from a black girl in my school. And that was like, I was looking at her like, you're the same color as I am. I really don't get
You don't
that.
Get it?
Yeah, so it took a while to just understand the American culture. I was
sometimes people become indoctrinated with their own hatred, self-hatred.
Yes, and, but that's kids, though, too.
Yeah, but kids grow up into adults.
That's true.
And then you have artists who use the word, and they make it more prolific to be used.
Right.
I mean, at some point in time, I thought we buried the word.
Yeah, I thought we were going
But then the
to.
Next record came out, and they made
the
millions
record.
Of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
And they resurrected the word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Am I right or wrong?
It's very sad because I thought that when that word came out and when the B word came out, I said, this isn't going to stick because this is just common sense. It's disrespectful. But it's stuck.
Well, the people who are using the word inappropriately so are being terminated off of their perch positions. Using the word, I know cooking show hosts, other folks that are in positions.
But I mean, I don't even mean necessarily on that level. I'm saying that
just
explicit lyrics. I mean, NWA came out with their album, and then explicit lyrics became a popular, known, common thing. Now you see it in comedy shows, and it's the norm.
The genie is out of the bottle.
Way out of the bottle, yeah. And it ain't going back in.
I don't think she's going back in. I think she got too much weight on right now, so that ain't going to happen.
No, right. Right.
So you had this transition as a 12-year-old being indoctrinated into American culture, into American lifestyle. What would you say to someone who's coming here as an immigrant? Why was indoctrinated? Was it a positive thing, or was it a necessary thing, or was it? How would you describe it as you transition? I mean, as you deal with that transition.
It was an oxymoron. I'm not going to say it wasn't a. It was a positive thing because I think that if I was in England, I don't think that I would have become what I am today, and I think I would have been a lot more stagnant. It was a shocking thing because I lost some of myself without even knowing it.
What does that mean?
So what it means is that losing my accent was huge.
Okay, that was a part of who you are.
That's part of who I am.
Okay,
and when you have an accent like that, that sets you apart. And so the thing that I got teased for, and then to hear women say of my brother, oh, your accent is sexy. I'm like, whoa, I used to like really, really talk like that. Now I have to.
You have to resurrect
it up. And that's crazy. Now it comes. And I was in England several years ago and I just saw some of my uncles and it comes back when I'm around them.
Oh, okay.
But to see that was a part of me and to not have it, it's like, ooh, that does something to you.
It does.
In addition, also, being Jamaican back then wasn't a popular thing. But then when reggae began to like...
Bob Marley.
Yes. And reggaeton and different ones began to get popular. Then it was like... And then Jamaican restaurants started popping up all over Boston. Then it was like, oh, I'm Jamaican. And it was like... Oh, all of a sudden now we have pride.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like what's so that does something to your mind in terms of how society controls the media.
Oh, it does. That's right. And when you see people doing their imitation of Bolt, in terms of he's the fastest man on the planet.
Right.
Happened to be of Jamaican descent.
Exactly.
That boy's bad.
He's a bad boy.
He's right.
But it's a shame that we have to gain new popularity again to get accepted. Instead of just being, because before it was, oh, you talk funny. But then if you get famous, it's like, oh, you're sexy.
Okay, so, like, you're, I know, because if you're from England, you don't do no patois, do you, man?
No, you do. You should hear my family speak. Perfect combination of both. It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling, yeah.
Because you said, we spend our time in England with manners and with...
No, we do, but we still eat our yam and banana and our dumpling and when we talk that talk. Because
so you're real making?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Just wanted to check.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And so what I do remember, I had that dual culture of, and this is what I'm saying in terms of today, how we're losing so much. I was telling... some friends of mine, I said, listen, if you dated someone, like if I meet a girl and she's from anywhere from the Caribbean, not just Jamaican, like it could be Haitian or anywhere, she automatically has points because we're from the Caribbean and there,
Western or Eastern Caribbean.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And there's an automatic commonality. But now it's not like that. If you lose your culture because you've been in America so long, you now get Americanized, which is not cool.
But you made the point that marketing has told us what is beautiful or has told us what is valuable.
Yes.
Told us how we should see ourselves and know our place.
Right. So, for instance, I was not comfortable with my complexion until I was in my probably late 20s.
Wow.
Because all the light-skinned guys were getting all the girls.
You got a thing for girls, don't you?
just a little. A little sub. We can put that out there. I don't mind putting that out there.
I ain't married to that.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, I'm right there with you, but I'm married now. But I wasn't always.
But you know what I'm saying? Like that was, and so it took me a while just to accept
who you were,
who I was,
the skin that you're in.
Yes, black, exactly.
Black like me.
Yeah.
But you know, we came up through this era, but being black. Or that transition, because if you go back to the 40s and 50s and early 60s, we were trying to mimic white America.
Right.
We had the Murray's Grease, the finger
wave. We had that in the 80s.
You have it in the 80s?
Yeah, man, I remember Murray's in my ears and getting waved.
Well, it took you a while to catch up, huh?
I was following the culture.
But I can remember very clearly when we started to grow afros, we had black people who were not consciously aware that we were trying to break out of this mold of trying to be more. We would spend $1 million to act like we were white or dress like we were white, talk like we were white, as opposed to being ourselves.
Right.
And then white folks would go and spend $3 million to get a tan so they can look like us.
Right.
So we were spending money to look like them, talk like them, walk. They were spending money to look like us. Man, we are all messed up.
Lip injections, Botox in the buttons, all kind of.
We're all messed up.
Yeah, big time.
Trying to be something that we're not.
Right, exactly.
So I understand this black skin thing, but black is beautiful. It really
is. Absolutely, right.
But you have to be taught that. You have to be taught and you have to grow into your comfortability.
Right, exactly.
Because the way society treats us.
Yeah. You. So it took me a while to begin to just, you know, and I thank God for like the Eddie Murphys and who started to, you know, blow up, because when I was a teenager, it was the Albie Shores, the Christopher Williams, and I was like, dang, these light skin guys are killing it. They're just killing it. So then when Eddie Murphy came on the scene in Arsenio Hall, I was like, hey, so there's hope for us. And then it began to raise my confidence. And then just
Chris Rock too.
Chris Rock, yep.
Because they're darker skinned brothers
right.
as well. But
yeah.
But
yeah.
Eddie Murphy opened up the door.
Big time. Wesley Snipes.
Wesley.
You know what I'm saying? Yep. And so things like when you see things like that, it raises up your confidence, and then you begin to go on this path where you're like, hey, who I am is okay.
I think that's so important for people to hear, but also want to make sure that this binary, that light skin versus dark skin, that is something that was manufactured by, I believe it was coined in the Willie Lynch's letter to show how he can divide
big time
and have us be controlled 100 years after slavery is ended.
Yeah.
So that we, in fact, would, if you divide the light skin versus the dark skin, and if you take the biggest black in the group and just break them down in front of everybody, you can control the psyche.
Right, exactly.
And many of those issues that we have of getting along with one another are still prevalent today.
That's the truth.
Hundreds of years, Willie Lynch is dead and gone.
Yeah.
The slave owners are dead and gone.
Right.
However, the practices of what they instilled within us are carried over.
Right.
So our cultural bondage and our psychological bondage is still alive and well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that what you're that's I think you're saying?
I wrote about that.
Okay, we're gonna touch that on one of your books.
One of my big things is you have to renew your mind.
Right.
You know, redo over, and then get a new mind. You have to plug out of what everybody else wants for you, and you have to come into who you are, accept it, and then thrive in it. That's very important.
It is, but what you're really talking about is not only a consciousness of who you are, but you have a black consciousness as well, simultaneously, that is operating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Black Like Me, Native Son,
mm-hmm.
Roots.
Right.
All of those books were written out of the black experience.
Right.
That's what I believe I hear you
saying. Yeah, no, yes. And that's very, very important. It's about accepting who you are. And it's about, but it's got to come from you, and it's got to come from you. And then it's got to come from, okay, so here we go. It's got to come from your Heavenly Father. And the reason why I say that is because there has to be something that's deep rooted where you say, I don't care what everybody else is doing. This is it.
Okay. So you just introduced a topic about who you are as an element of your faith. And you're saying that your faith is what really has grounded you?
Absolutely. My faith is the fact that I am a Christian is deeper than the fact that I am a black man.
Okay.
I am a Christian before I am a black man.
Okay. No, I'm not laughing at that.
No, I know. I'm saying that.
What that says to me is the foundation in your house.
Absolutely.
Is built on spiritual principles.
Yes.
And a faith in God.
Right. Notice I didn't say going to church, because a whole bunch of people go to church and ain't doing nothing for them. It has to get into your psychic.
Well,
can't nobody tell me that.
You're pointing to your head. I would point to my heart first.
Okay, well, yeah. He's wrestling with me again, right?
Because out of the heart comes the issue.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you're right. But then it will
cause you to hear, to see, to think, to speak, to walk, and to handle. But the faith that you have, because it's the faith of the things, unseen.
Yes, right.
That you have faith in, that God will hear your prayer.
Right.
And cause you to act in a certain way.
Right.
Is that what I hear
you
articulating?
Yes, absolutely.
And so you mentioned writing, but tell me early on in your formative years, what really helped you find that voice, that writing was going to be your portal?
I started writing raps, poems, and songs when I was 13.
Raps and poems?
Raps. So I was the only person that was known that was going around the city of Boston doing raps about gospel or about Jesus at between 13 and 19. There wasn't many that came after me who was doing that. And I got some flack because they were like, who is this guy and what is he doing? You know what I mean? No one was doing that. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I'm saying. The beautiful thing when you look back on your life and as you begin to get older, you can see that, hey, I've been doing this thing for a while. I just didn't know I was doing it.
Okay, that's right.
You know?
Got you. Yeah, yeah.
So,
but you're being very descriptive to the listening audience. If you're just tuning in, David Carruthers, he is a licensed massage person, professional. He is an author of 5 books. He's been married. He has 2 children. What are your children's names?
Paige and Layla.
Okay, Paige and Layla. And do you have any grandkids?
I have 2 grandkids, Sophia and Elijah.
So what do they call you? Papa? Grandpa?
Pop. Yeah,
Pop. They call
Papa.
You Pop.
Yeah, Pop. Yeah,
I need some money.
I don't allow them to call me Grand. Grand, too old. It just sounds too old.
You, as they say, Papa. You're so vain, you think the song is about you?
You're funny.
So if I ever meet Elijah and Sophia, I'm gonna say go get some money from Grandpa. Hit him up, get him for 20 bucks for me.
Exactly. Oh man, I'd be like, Donald sent you.
So when you were doing rap and poems, and you were doing gospel, what was the connection? Because of your faith?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I would take the messages that I was hearing. And I would and God would give me raps about them. Now he would give me raps about them because I would listen to like Run DMC and Houdini. I was huge fans of those.
Okay, so you're hip hop generation.
Yeah, I was hip hop. Yeah,
hip hop generation.
Yeah,
big time.
And I was like, well, and I wasn't hearing anything, in the gospel. And so
you,
I said,
you hear him now, though, right?
Oh yeah, hear him now. Yeah, hear him now.
What's his name?
What's it, Lecrae?
No, not Donnie McCrick and
No, Lecrae. He's a gospel.
Yeah. But you got other. He's got his own radio show too. But anyway, it'll come to me in a minute. Yeah.
So I would say to myself, well, if they're doing that for, you know, their God or whatever, then why can't I do this for my God? And so I started,
amen.
I started rapping, and I started writing raps, and I started performing them. And
so you're doing more spoken word with your poems?
I didn't do a lot of I was rapping. I didn't
you
do
were rapping. You
yeah,
didn't, so I didn't you were, do spoken you were straight
word.
Up
I was
rapping.
Straight up
there's
rapping.
A difference from spoken word and
yeah,
rap.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I've only done a little bit of spoken word.
So y'all say.
Well, yeah, you're funny. Yeah, you could call it the same thing.
So spoken word with music is called rap.
Right, exactly.
And spoken word without music is called poem.
Spoken
word.
Yeah.
So I'm just an old school OG.
Yeah. So that's what I did, and I did that for in addition to you know singing on the choir and then doing some worship leading, but it was mainly the rapping.
Okay.
That I did a lot of.
So how did you find that rhythm? That rap brings. Was that because you practice a lot?
Or? I did. I did a lot of writing. And
in the mirror?
I don't necessarily do it in the mirror. I did some in the mirror. I didn't do it. I'm not that kind of person.
Okay.
I'm
just trying
just
to get to how did you,
I,
you,
I,
you get the
when you're
move?
Young, you know, when you're young, you really don't have a lot of fear.
Okay.
You just do it.
Okay, you just do it.
You got
certain moves that y'all make when y'all be
I mean, yeah. You watch. I love Run DMC.
Okay.
So you
That's
know,
right.
I had a big poster on them on my wall. So and my favorite
in
of
your
course
little
was
bedroom,
Run,
right?
In my bedroom,
your,
right?
Your, no,
my
I said
bedroom
little
that
bedroom.
I thought was mine. My mama's house, but this is my bedroom.
You are too funny. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to David Carruthers talking about his room, my room, and my mama's house.
Right, my room and my mama's house. My room.
It was your mama's refrigerator, too.
Yes, exactly. Mama's bed, mama's everything. But this is my stuff. Come in my room.
So when you're talking to your grandkids and your children, what do they say? Pop.
They say, well, one of them is young. One of them is young. And the other one is just beginning to speak. So, but my daughter, she does. It's funny how
Paige.
Paige is a monster at spoken word.
Oh, wow.
And she's also a writer. She has her own blog.
Okay.
But my other daughter is
Layla?
A singer. Yeah, she's a singer. She's a dancer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's very interesting because Paige does not know how to sing. Can't sing a lick, which is irritating because she cried like crazy when she was a baby.
If you're just tuning to the Community Focus program, we're listening to David Carruthers. We will continue this conversation in the next segment. This is the Community Focus program with Darnell Williams on Sports Radio 93.7 WEEI.
Community Focus.
Thanks for listening to Community Focus on WEEI with Darnell Williams.
Community Focus.
This is Sports Radio 93.7 WEEI and WEEI.com, Boston.
Community Focus.
The following WEEI public service broadcast is brought to you by the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Community Focus.
You're listening to Community Focus on WEEI with Darnell Williams from the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Good morning, everyone out there in the listening world. This is Darnell Williams, President and CEO of the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts, welcoming you once again to the Community Focus program. I'm so humbly grateful that we have David Carruthers in the studio with us this morning, and we're going to be talking about a range of items about him, about the five books that he's written, and we're going to get to know David and share David's journey with us. So, David, what I'd like for you to do is to tell us, we were talking about your love for writing, and I want to get to some of your books.
Okay.
But I'm still trying to tease out of you, so to speak. What really was it that really sparked you to say that I can write? Because I have writing, off in my humble opinion, it gives you a alternative voice or viewpoint that you're trying to influence others to see things based on your experience. Is that a fair assessment for a writer?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
But how would you say it in your words, though, instead of just taking my words for it?
I would say that, well, what it does, it gives you an edge, but you don't know that at the time.
It gives you an edge. What does that mean?
If you start any kind of writing, and if you publish it, or if you go, even if you don't publish it, if you do a spoken word, if you rap, and then people like it, it gives you an edge, because what it does is that people are saying, hey, I like what you have created.
Okay, gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? So that gives you a confidence, that gives you an edge, that says, hey, I'm good at what I do.
Okay.
I'm going to keep doing it. And this is who I am.
Okay.
So when I first started to write, I didn't know, honestly, when I started to write the first book, I didn't know what I was. As a matter of fact, I was writing, and I said to God, I said, what is this? I said, this feels like a book. And then he says, it is a book. And I told him throughout the years of writing that first book several times, I said, you got the wrong one. You got the wrong one. I cannot do this.
Okay, Moses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And several times. And he kept saying, nope, I got the right one. I got the right one. And after a 5-year process, and the process is more important than the goal, I finished my first book.
So it took you 5 years to produce the first book. So were there promptings inside your spirit to push
there
you?
Was. There was a, you know, I heard Ron Carpenter said that you live life on levels but in seasons. And so
say, wait a minute, repeat that one more time.
You live life on levels in seasons.
Okay.
So life is about different kind of levels. So there are some things that are not going to come to people until you get to a certain level.
I got you. I'm listening.
You know what I'm saying?
So, no, I'm absorbing what you're saying.
So, yeah. So people, like, there are quotes that are out there that I like to display. Or not even display. I totally come against because I don't agree with them. Like people say, everybody's created equal. No, we're not.
Okay.
No, we're not. We're created equal in the fact that we're people.
Yeah, humanity.
Yeah,
you're talking about
that's
the
about
creation.
It.
Creation of you as an individual in the family of humanity is equal.
Yes.
But what you're talking about, talent, skills, and what makes
right.
you different.
Definitely not equal.
They're not
equal.
They're not equal.
Right.
There.
Because your talent is going to open up massive doors for you that the average person isn't going to get.
Okay,
and some of that is going to be because of talents, but some of that is also going to be because of drive. So in writing this book, it elevated.
Years.
Right.
It elevated. It elevated what?
It elevated my thinking. So here's what I say now. Writing Kill Your Giants and completing it was my Superman moment.
Okay, gotcha.
I found out who I was in writing that. Because that book was the, oh, shoot, I realize what was holding me back all these years. It, writing that book was the, okay.
It wasn't your black skin.
Wasn't my black skin, right. It was my thinking.
It was
about
your thinking
my
about
black
your black skin.
Skin. Right. It was my thinking about relationships and about the way I was brought up and about and just about a lot of the things that, and I had to have the boldness to be able to address some of the things that came from my house, that came from the pulpit. And I had to be able to dispel them and say, no, that was wrong.
But let me ask you this question, and I want you to spend a few minutes telling people, what does it take to publish a book? But I want to deal with some other issues, because you haven't mentioned this, but I want to just ask you,
okay,
were there any personal fears or doubts that were in your mind in that 5-year process?
Yes.
Okay.
Then... Well, one of the giants in the book is the giant of fear.
Okay. So let's talk about the title of that first book.
Okay.
The title of your first book was Kill Your Giants.
Yes.
And who designed that cover for you?
This woman, Emily Russell, designed the cover for me.
Okay.
So you asked kind of like a twofold question. So the process, sure, of writing or developing a book, yeah, it's a lot of work. You got to get a designer. You got to get a publisher. That's really a whole, it's almost a whole show within itself, because there's just a process in it.
How about you give me the Cliff version?
The Cliff version. The Cliff version is know what you want to write,
okay,
know why you want to write it,
okay,
and then once you write it,
you have to do like a rough draft.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you pass it on to a particular publisher.
Well,
or you get somebody else to edit it.
No,
you
want to polish it up as much as you possibly can. Once you know it's done, that's when you send it to the editor. The editor's job then is to beat it up and to clean it up, and then you find your publisher. And your cover design artist.
Now, let me ask you the question. When you send it to the editor, like you say, they're going to clean it up and beat it up.
Mm-hmm.
And they will come back to you if they have questions about what you read, is not,
yeah,
clear.
Right, yes.
And you get a chance to kind of revise it.
Right,
because, yeah, the best writers are the best editors.
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
I suck at editing.
Oh, okay. Well, see, for me, I'm talking about maybe a memo is totally different, or a letter is different than a book.
Way different. Way different, yeah.
But we were always taught that you should print it out, review it, edit it.
I mean, yeah, you should, but editing is an art in itself.
Okay, that's good. Okay, that's good.
So
okay.
my editor edits. I don't edit.
You just write.
I just write.
Okay.
I mean, but I write and I rewrite and I rewrite. Now I'm to the place where I don't really have to edit a lot, but at the same time, I'm going to bring it to an editor.
Okay.
Because if I don't, that's,
the editor has a role.
Right.
Now, when you go to the publisher, do you get any money for bringing a edited document to the publisher? Do you get any money up front?
I self-published.
Self-published?
Yeah, I self-published.
So what does that mean?
It means that what I tell aspiring writers is that you're really not on the level to find a publisher. And
okay,
what I mean by that is that what big real publishers want to see is that they want to see that you're moving some units. And if you ain't moving some units, why would they publish you?
In other words, you gotta put your dues in. As they say, you gotta have a audience,
yeah,
that is actually going to,
right,
buy the books, and the books that they're buying is going to make money not only for the publisher but also for you.
Right. Right.
And so now when you do self-publishing, you're selling the book for a certain price, but most of that money comes back to pay for your time, sweat, and tears, pay your editor, and paying your and your design,
right,
person.
Right,
is that fair?
It's somewhat fair. But when you're doing it yourself,
mm-hmm,
that's what it is. You're doing it yourself. You, okay, are the artist.
Well, how do you get your books out there?
Well, you got to do stuff like this.
You got to talk about it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You got to put it. You have to become a monster at guerrilla marketing and promoting and advertising.
Okay.
And trying to get some affiliates and some associates to really, really push you.
Okay. Guerrilla marketing and social media.
Yep. Social media. Yep.
Is there any other vehicle that you would have to use?
I mean, that's enough.
Those two right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about Kill Your Giants. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to David Carruthers, who's written 4 or 5 books, and we're going to spend the next 10 to 15 minutes, and we're going to try to talk about each book. But tell people from a process standpoint of view, how did you arrive at the title, and what is the essence of Kill Your Giants?
Okay, so I arrived at the title. Honestly, I was just chilling in my living room, and I heard this voice say, Kill Your Giants.
Okay.
And I was like, what's that?
Okay, so you didn't know what that meant.
I had no idea
at the time.
Now, here's the key, though. Mm-hmm. I heard the voice say, write it down. And I did.
You wrote it down?
I wrote it down. Very, very important that you do the little things, because the so-called little, there really are no little things. The little things are the big things and vice versa.
Okay.
Most people abandon or they just ignore the little things, and that's why they don't hit the big things.
Do the big things.
Right. That's one. Two, The essence of Kill Your Giants is that a giant is anything that stops your destiny. You have to identify what's wrong in your life. You have to embrace it. And so what I saw these giants were anger, pride, fear, lust, and rejection.
Wait a moment, slow down. Okay. Anger, pride, fear. Fear.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Lust. And rejection. Everybody deals with those.
Okay.
Now, my job is to identify in detail what they are doing to your destiny.
Okay. But let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. These are very powerful words. But what were you angry about?
Good question. One of the things that I was angry about was, well, I went through a divorce, so I was angry about that. I was angry at the fact that I didn't have a father, and I couldn't.
You had a father. You just didn't have a relationship with him.
Yeah, and I don't know him. I don't know where he. Okay. You know what I mean?
So I just want to clarify.
Yeah. So I was angry about that because I couldn't wrap around my mind why this man named Daddy wouldn't want me. Okay. And it didn't make sense.
Especially having kids and grandkids.
Yeah, it was like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I had to deal with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the reason why I had to deal with that is because there was a lot of anger. Because I was like, I basically was like, I remember being in church one day. And, the anger came from saying, and I just told somebody this a couple of weeks ago at the Thanksgiving dinner.
Okay.
I says, I'm in my 40s and I'm still catching up because I didn't have a father. We underestimate way too much in the black community not having a father.
A father figure, right. But your biological father, you want that person to have a relationship.
Because what he does is that he sets the foundation in your life.
Okay. That's so critically important.
It's massively critical. If you look at the Department of Justice, just some of the mm-hmm. some of the statistics, 85% of youth that are in prison come from fatherless homes. A young lady that does not have a father is 53% more likely to get pregnant, 711% likely to have a child, and then 92% likely to get a divorce because she did not have a father.
Wow.
And there are numerous others.
Yeah, talk about your pride and then we're going to go.
Pride is basically, are you teachable? You know what I'm saying? If something's wrong, say what it is.
But can you get coaching or feedback?
Yeah. You know what I mean? Stop. A lot of our arguments don't even have to be arguments, but they grow into these arguments because no one wants to say, I'm wrong. And then if you're never wrong, you don't grow.
Yeah.
So how can you be empowered if you don't grow?
Right. I know. So then talk
about...
There
goes the marriage.
Yeah. Communication is a two-way street. And then the question that I always say to people, I say, will the love last when the love shine wears off?
Mm. I talked about that. So you're saying love shine. I call it infatuation.
Infatuation. Same thing.
Yeah, okay.
It's synonymous.
Right.
Because you're so much in love with this person that is in your life, and everything that they say and do is okay. And then somewhere down the road, when you stop kicking the can and you realize there's some idiosyncrasies that you didn't see.
Right.
That I didn't know that they were there.
Right.
Because you're so infatuated focusing on the love shine.
Right. The love shine. That's what I must be in old school there. The love shine. I think I'm going to use that. Maybe you got some love shine for me.
I'm just saying. So let's leave the love shine alone and talk about what were you afraid of and what were you lusting after? Because you mentioned you like girls or women. That's what you said. I'm going to get both of them out of you.
You're funny. Here's what I was afraid of. That's a great question.
Yes, sir.
I remember going to my appointments. I think it was for counseling or whatever. And I used to see the poem, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. The deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. And I would read that, and I would, as a teenager, and I would be like, hey, stupid adults, why would I be afraid of what's great in me? And why would I be afraid of my... And then when I wrote that book, Kill Your Giants, and I started telling God I couldn't do it, guess what came back to mind? Our deepest fear is not
our deepest
that
fear.
We are inadequate.
Oh, man, that article. Deepest I mean, that fear. Poem. Was that a poem?
Yeah, it was a poem. Okay. Deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. You know why? Because you separate yourself from average people.
Okay.
I was afraid of that.
Wow. You know how revealing that is for people to hear you say that? That you came to the realization that these giants that were in your thinking really were keeping you from having your destiny.
Yeah.
And so you really, so talk about the lust and the rejection, and then we're going to go book number two.
So the rejection primarily was honestly my father, okay. Not having a father. I wrote a song called No Daddy in My Home. So between not having a daddy in my home, not being comfortable in my dark skin, not loving who I am, going to church, wondering why am I feeling this way, and now here I am. I got married at 23, and now I'm getting divorced at 30. I'm like, this is not in my vision, and so you begin to write this stuff, and you see that you have been afraid of mindsets.
It's very powerful.
Very powerful.
That's very powerful.
Very,
what you're
very,
saying.
Very powerful. And so the afraid was I was.
So you were angry, and you were the rejection was really tightly connected.
The rejection was huge. The rejection was tightly connected because we're born with this. Who's going to love me? And I'm loved, right? I knew that my mother loved me. No question. But I grew up saying, where's my dad?
You don't know what your emotions, the emotions from your dad were absent.
Absent.
So you had to fill that void up, but you filled it up with anger and rejection.
Yes.
And that became a barrier and a giant in your thinking because you think that you were rejected as a young black boy.
Right, right. Because I'm like, why does he want me? But then when you look at it in your community, you're like 80, 90% of the kids don't have fathers. So I guess this is just the way it is. But I'm like, this can't be the way it is.
No, it's complicated.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, we don't know what the relationship was between your mom and your dad.
I know.
And, you know, just like we don't know the relationship. You said that you were divorced. So, you know, you are a good guy from my vantage point, mm-hmm. from what I know of you. Mm-hmm. But we don't demonize the other person because we don't know all the details.
Right, right.
Because we don't know what goes on behind closed doors.
We don't. But the reason why Kill Your Giants is important because I had to pour all that junk out of me. It was a purging process.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's purge number three and
big
four.
Big time. Big time. And then so once I got it out, I was like,
you were free. Free at last?
Oh, boy. Yeah, free at last. Yeah, I was free, exactly.
You notice that you skirted around the lust. I'm going to let you off the hook on that.
No, well, honestly, because the lust, I really don't feel like I had lust. I love women. I do love women, absolutely.
Well, you ain't but by
I,
yourself?
I don't think, huh?
You ain't by yourself?
Right. But I really don't think that I had a lust problem. I wrote about lust because what... So from a
Christian perspective, not, in your foundation.
Yes. The lust of
the eyes.
Yes, that too. The beautiful thing about this stuff mm-hmm. and about God and what's amazing is that all the stuff that you hear, it comes back up in your remembrance and you're like, oh my God. Writing is amazing.
It is. It's a releasing.
It's such a release.
It's a release.
But here's why I wrote about lust, and here's what scared me, to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
I saw friends that were my age who had major lust problems, and I was like, I don't want that.
Yeah, you said it a different way, and I'm going to say it for you. God, whatever you make me to become, just don't make me become one of them.
Don't make me be like that, right. Exactly.
Because, you know, it's almost like when David saw the Spirit of God leave Saul, he said, and after Bathsheba and all of the stuff that he did, he says, whatever it is that I did, I'm confessing.
Right.
Because I don't want the Spirit of God to leave
right.
me.
Right.
And once you leave, because once you, he said, this is what happens to you. So he was fearful of losing the Spirit of God and the anointing on his life.
Right.
So when you are acknowledging that, you are acknowledging more beyond measure for what happens in people's lives.
Right.
Because they're not dealing with these giants.
That's key.
That's so key.
That's key.
So your second book, Reactors, Why You Do What You Do. What does that mean?
Okay, so Reactors is about why you do what you do.
The title.
Yeah. Reactors is
and purpose.
Two different kind of reactors. There are followers and there are leaders. followers react to anything and everything, and which is why they do anything and everything, and they don't lead a life.
Maybe ask him about what happened.
What's that?
People who follow.
Oh yeah, what happened?
What
exactly.
happened?
What happened? Right. Three kinds of people: those who ask what happened, those who know what happened, and those who make things happen.
That's right.
Yeah,
and then you probably have complainers somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, definitely in there. And then there are reactors that are leaders. Those are the ones that focus on their destiny. And so the why you do what you do is important, because if you don't know why, then you'll keep repeating a folly.
Wow.
But the turnaround to that is, if you do know why, you'll keep repeating greatness.
So what you're saying is that this is more like an efficacy kind of a book, where you're asking people to really examine your behavior and your actions.
Yes.
And then once you do an honest analysis,
right,
you can lift the separate.
Yes.
And then once you do that, then you can say, how do I repeat success?
Right.
And build upon that in order to find a avenue that is going to kill my giants and move forward and make progress.
Exactly.
Is that what those two books are kind of?
Exactly, yeah. That's my whole ministry. My whole ministry is, let's identify what's wrong so that we can do what's right. Let's identify what's right so that we can keep doing it.
You're laughing. I think there's a phrase that I use in my travels that says, we're going to focus in on the what, not the who.
Mm.
Because you focus in on the books of do what you do, why you do what you do, that's focusing on the what. What am I doing?
Yes.
Or why are you doing it?
Yes.
And if it's not helping you, you need to lose it.
Right.
Your third book.
But you have to know what it is, though.
That's right. Your third book, You're Such a Liar.
You're Such a Liar.
That's a powerful,
very friendly title.
Very friendly. Friendly to who?
I don't know.
but we should sign one and send it to Washington, D.C.
Oh, God, you went there.
And everybody in the cabinet.
Oh, man. Yeah, I know, right? Free of charge.
Free of charge. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Can I, let me, how much is the book?
that book's 15.
15.
Like 12 total.
So we got to get 15. That's $150, and I got to do I got to do shipment.
No, free. That's free. Shipping to hell is free.
Oh, God, we're having fun.
Here's the thing about the book. So the subtitle is How Fate Corrupts the Soul.
Okay.
And I honestly wrote that book. That book is an oxymoron, because I've been raised in church, and
what denomination are you? If you're
I'm Christian.
Christian. What does that mean? Baptist, Catholic.
Means all that.
Okay. Non-denominational?
Yeah, basically. I don't get caught up too much in the denominations. I believe in Jesus. I believe in love. I believe in the Holy Spirit. I believe in,
They even have a name for that, too.
I'm sure they do. But that book came out of the fact that I was around Christians and being in church, and I saw some things where I was like, yo, you're just lying.
Okay.
You're just lying.
So you saw... Your words and your behaviors are different.
Yeah.
And then if you put the scripture as the guideline or the guidepost, their words were saying what the scripture says, but their behavior was opposite.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Like one of my things, especially as I get older, one of the things that I say now is that Jesus said, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. Anything else is from the evil one.
Okay. That's so true. But that's so hard to execute, because we want to please people.
Yeah.
We want to get along.
Mm.
Yeah. But no, I'm not diminishing.
I know. Yeah. I know. I'm just saying.
I know. Your whole body language is saying that that's a bologna sandwich.
Well, I mean, you know why? Because remember I said earlier, I said I dispel certain quotes. Here's a quote that I don't like. People say, oh, we fell out of love, or we fell in love. We fell out of love. Well, my thing is like, well, fall back in.
Man, are you crazy?
No. Let me tell you what I mean.
If you fall out of love with somebody, that's tough to fall back in love with them again.
I have two daughters, right?
Yes, sir. We already identified
if
that.
If one of my daughters kills 10 people, I'm coming to the judge like, life? Don't you think that's a little much, Your Honor? Can we give 10 years, like one for each life? Life, like that's a bit much. I'm always gonna back up my daughter. I'm always going to love my daughter. I'm gonna visit if they're in jail for the rest of their life. I'm gonna visit them. I can't fall out of love with my children. How do you fall out of love with the one who gave you the children? That's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it's very interesting, but you know, the notion that you you're doing is you're saying is that no one is going to talk about their child or the children that they bring into life. But when we talk about falling in love with a person that, you know, that you thought that was committed to walk down this path and this journey with you, and things change, people change, and you kind of, you grow apart. And therefore,
I don't agree with that.
Okay, well, tell us why.
Because, well, a few reasons. In writing that book, You're Such a Liar,
right?
I read this book called The Day America Told the Truth.
Okay.
That book, it's a book on statistics in terms of the morality, in terms mm-hmm. of what mm-hmm. Americans do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Things like 78 to 91% of Americans lie, and they lie when they're challenged. 30% of now-divorced women at the time that they got married, they knew it was wrong. We're doing things
so they were unequally yoked from the beginning,
from the
is what
beginning.
You're saying. If you're just tuning in to the Community Focus program, I just want to remind the listening audience that every Tuesday and Wednesday at the Urban League at 1 o'clock, what we have are informational programs to tell you of all the programs in terms of our coding, our digital design, our customer service, our computer, our learning and internet knowledge, our financial literacy, all the programs that we run, our domestic violence, sexual assault. You will be able to get information about those programs every Tuesday and Wednesday at 1 o'clock. If you're just tuning in, you're tuning in to David Carruthers. He's talked about his three books. One that we were just talking about, You're Such a Liar, based on his faith and his observations around Christians and their behaviors versus their words. The other two books that we talked about was The Reactors, Why Do You Do What You Do? And then the third one's The Kill Your Giants. And those are killing the giants are things that are inside of you that are keeping you from your destiny. Did I describe
yes.
those books?
Yes.
And then spend a few minutes talking about your latest book, 30 Days of Real. What does that mean?
So 30 Days of Real is a devotional. So each day there is a chapter that you read. You reflect on it. And then it's designed to bring out a greater you.
Okay. And so basically you're going back to your roots again, your foundation of spirituality. So when you get these titles and you get these words that are pouring out of you,
mm-hmm.
this is God's way of using you as a channel, as an ambassador to write these down so others will be blessed by the blessing that he's giving you.
Yes.
Is that what you're, is what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
So this is a 30-day spiritual plan.
Yeah. It's not just spiritual, but you can call it spiritual. I mean,
What would you call it? It's
Motivational, inspirational. It's not. I mean, there's. I mean, there's definitely some God things in there. It's a devotional. It is a book basically designed to say, hey, let's talk about some real stuff.
Okay.
And when I mean real stuff, I mean everything.
Give us an
from,
app. Yeah.
Very first one is live your dreams. Sometimes when people hear that, they shrink back and then they don't. They don't dive into that because they think of their dreams as just way far off. But there are aspects of your dreams that you're living right now. There always are. First of all, you're alive, you're healthy. What are your goals? What are your short-term goals? And have you achieved any of those? You should celebrate that. Don't just wait for the house and the marriage. Celebrate the fact that you
can do your own thing.
Yeah.
But you know how hard that is for people to do? Just to break out of that cycle of doubt, poverty, insecurity, sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That's not easy to do.
It's not. And
without coaching.
Right. But that's why it's broken down into
30 days.
So each day you read something and you reflect on it. Most people and most of us, we hear amazing information that can revolutionize our lives, but we don't. Because we're just too busy and we're not slowing down enough for things to just settle and take residence so that it can blossom.
Yeah. What's the phrase that always says, sometimes you just be still.
Yeah.
Be silent.
Mm-hmm.
Be quiet. And let God speak to your heart. And you'll be amazed at what
comes.
It's like And it's not like beating you over the head with it. It's a small unction.
Yep, exactly.
That comes out. Exactly. And God is talking directly to you about what he wants you to do.
Right.
But you got to be quiet in order to hear it.
Right, right, right.
Not nobody right. chimpering in your ear, yeah. the radio going, right. Right. headsets, your MP3, what yeah. is playing. No, just be quiet.
Right.
And be still.
Right.
So let's see if we can do it in a way to wrap it up, Mr. Carruthers. You have come on this show. If you had some parting words that you want to share with the listening audience about the Giants, 30 Days of Rio, the other two books, what would you say to them?
I would say that believe and understand that there is greatness in you. Like really, really believe that.
You got to believe it. Hold on to it like it's real.
Right, yeah, yeah. It has to become real to you like it's your name. Embrace your failures because your failures, your pain, that's where your prosperity is.
Wow, that is so powerful. If you have just tuned in to the Community Focus program, this is Dr. D in the house. David Carruthers talked about his books, talked about his life. This has been the Community Focus program. I wish blessings upon each of you who are listening to this program. May you go out and have a great day and a blessed week.
Community Focus.
Thanks for listening to Community Focus on WEEI with Darnell Williams.
Community Focus.
This is Sports Radio 93.7 WEEI and WEEI.com, Boston.